If it pleases the court, my name is Craig Johnson. I represent the petitioner, Jason Carr. Today, Jason Carr will turn 50 years old after serving 33 years in prison for offenses he had committed when he was 16 years old. However, he will not be eligible for parole until the year 2033 after serving a minimum of 50 years on a natural life sentence. On appeal, the appellate court noted that Jason had never been in serious trouble before. He was a good student, A's and B grades. His actions near the time showed that he had severe mental problems. But the jury and the judge, nobody was able to give any consideration for his youth or any of that mitigating circumstances because at the time, they were required to give him 50 years without parole, well, actually life sentence with a minimum of 50 years without parole. In stark contrast, recently, Senate Bill 590 was enacted in which 80 juveniles, homicide offenders, who also committed deliberate murders are eligible for parole in only 25 years. And their parole board, after 25 years, and some of them are eligible now, will be able to consider all of the Miller-type factors because it's required under statute. Jason, on the other hand, will not be required to get that consideration. Will have to do twice the amount of time as those homicide offenders. He is serving a disproportionate sentence.
Now, the statute addresses first-degree murder, and Mr. Carr was sentenced as capital murder. Does this distinction make any difference?
I don't think so, because they just changed the name, in essence. Back in the capital murder, it was a premeditated, deliberated homicide, and they changed the name to murder first-degree for a deliberate homicide. The cases that interpreted premeditation, deliberation, pretty much have gave the same type of meaning as our current definition of deliberation.
Could you speak up a little or put it up a little higher? Okay. I think they must have turned it down at the break, so it's
okay.
A little quiet.
Because I kept sending messages, turn down the mic.
You might pull it up just a little closer to your mouth if you would.
Sorry about that.
Thank you.
Okay. I believe that that's evidence that he's serving a fortunate sentence. Now, the question is, clearly Miller dealt with a life without parole sentence, okay? I understand that, but that was just happened to be the sentence that he served. There's nothing in that language that would indicate, for instance, could a legislature do an end run around Miller by saying, okay, we'll say life without parole for 100 years?
So is it your argument that Miller itself addressed the situation and the statute does, or that the reasoning in Miller requires us to apply the same principles here?
I think it's the reasoning, and also, first of all, I think the statute makes it a disproportionate sentence, but aside from that, I think the reason in Miller, as then evidenced by the Montgomery Court.
Which statute?
I'm sorry.
Which statute?
557-04.
You mean the Miller fix statute?
The Senate Bill 590.
Disproportionality of a sentence is determined at the time that it's given, not after the fact, right? Same way with proportionality.
Well, I think I cited some case. Now, there are other jurisdictions in my brief that showed that actually an enactment of later statutes can turn a person's sentence a disproportionate, and I believe those analysis would apply here because
under the Eighth Amendment or what
under the Eighth Amendment it was a Georgia case and I forget the other case, but they applied a Florida case and they basically said, well, you know, the statute changed and now we're looking back and it's clear that this is now has become a disproportionate sentence. But I don't think you have
are you arguing that Mr. Carr comes within the effect of Senate Bill 590, or are you just arguing that Senate Bill 590 is a factor that should weigh into proportionality?
I think it's a factor it should weigh. Technically, the Senate Bill 590, it says first-degree murder, and this is capital murder. I think it's a distinction without meaning. And it says life without parole, and our sentence is life without parole for 50. So hyper-technically, no, it doesn't come within the statute, but I do think it's relevant. In the
and is it your argument that just as prior to passage of that, this court, under common law principles and Plapply, Miller, Montgomery, and Graham found that life without parole sentences were improper and applied retroactively, that we should use comparable principles here, guided by the statute and by our prior decisions?
Correct. In fact, I think...
What about the fact that Miller says there are some people who can still get life without parole?
Well, you can if you're able to present your mitigation. Mm-hmm. But here, this was a mandatory. So Carr isn't saved by that language because his was a mandatory sentence. Mm-hmm. Now, if he would have, for instance, some states have enacted statutes to basically allow for a resentencing hearing. Now, if you had a resentencing hearing where you could try to get parole after 25 years and be able to present your mitigation, that would be a different subject. But so Miller, while it allows a life without parole sentence, it doesn't allow a mandatory life without parole sentence.
But Miller doesn't prohibit this particular sentence.
Well, he technically, and it was life without parole instead of life without parole for 50. But I think, for instance, could a state then say, okay, we'll do life without parole for 100 years?
Only the United States Supreme Court can tell us that. I suppose they didn't give a minimum in Montgomery. They suggested 25 was certainly okay.
Well, I certainly think that's a foreshadowing as to a number that the court, out of all the states.
But didn't Montgomery itself, he was serving his 46th year, and the court said in Montgomery that that's a violation of his Eighth Amendment rights, and that it was error not to have given him a hearing by that point. It didn't specify what between 25 and 46, where the line was, but it said that was too much and he had to have a hearing by that point.
Right. And so I do think that they have
Do you have anything to add in response to my question?
I'm sorry.
Did Judge Stith cover everything that you wanted to cover in response to my question?
I'm sorry, what was your question again?
I interrupted. I apologize.
Okay.
I think that the Montgomery court, while technically they didn't put a maximum a number cap of years, I think they had a number of statutes. It's not like they cited all of these statutes and say, states can give parole, and they gave a number of statutes. They picked one particular statute out. They could have picked one with 40 years or whatever. They picked the one out with 25. Not only did they pick it out, Wyoming, it's not like alphabetical order or anything. They picked out Wyoming, and that in parentheses, they even put the number of years, 25 years. Now, while they are not saying this is what's required, I think at least foreshadows or shows their intent. This is the type of sentence we're talking about. And I was given the example, could a state give life without parole for 100 years? That clearly would not comply with Miller or Montgomery. So it shows that there has to be a line drawn somewhere. Okay? We know 25 years is good because Montgomery has told us, in essence, 25 is good. This court, apparently, when they drafted the order giving parole for the 80 first-degree murder juveniles, pick 25 years. I assume it was because, and maybe it's a false assumption, the 25 years in Montgomery, the court felt confident that we will at least be constitutionally okay. We know that 25 is good. Anything beyond that, we don't know. So we pick 25.
You say we know that 100 years would not be okay, but I think the state will say anything is okay as long as it doesn't say without parole.
Well, then Miller makes no sense. I mean, it's meaningless. If a legislature can go in and say life without parole for 200 years instead of life without parole, then Miller effectively means nothing. It just means that the legislature has to be more creative in giving life without parole sentence.
So you're saying that in this sentence, Mr. Carr received is a functional equivalent of a life without parole.
Correct.
Then where do we draw the line? Looking at Graham and some of the other cases, where is it not functionally equivalent.
I think the closer you get to 100, you're in trouble, and the closer you get to 25, you're good. And the legislatures, as I've cited all the ones in the brief, pretty much fall within 20 to 30. That's a pretty comfortable range, I think. Only a couple of them have given 40. Is 40 going to be good enough? I guess we'll have to find out. But we know 25 is good. We know that there's at least a consensus now that 25. Missouri, in fact, for the prior 80, had picked 25. Terrence Graham, coincidentally, was resentenced to 25 years. Montgomery mentions 25 years. This court issued an order saying 25 years. So I think that the closer you get to 25, the safer you are. Twice the amount, 50 years, I don't believe it's sufficient.
Counsel, if Mr. Carr had raised this issue at the time of sentencing, and he had prevailed, and it was Carr, not Miller, that was the U.S. Supreme Court guiding light here, under Nathan, we would have sent him down to be resentenced, and he still would have faced the possibility of life, no parole before 50 years.
But that,
why is he in a better position now than because he didn't raise it than he would have been if he had raised and prevailed?
Well, certainly that is a possible option for this court to do, is to give resentencing and allow him to put on his mitigation under the Hart opinion. I do think that there have been some indications in Montgomery and some of the opinion in Miller that maybe there's going to be more movement in the direction. I think that actually the court's moving towards outlawing life without parole for even homicide offenders. They certainly said we don't have to reach that decision. And then the Montgomery opinion comes forth and says, well, you have to show that this person is irreparably corrupt to keep him in forever. And so I think that there's an indication that maybe there would be more than Hart or Nathan procedure would require at this point in time. I do know that the simple fix, of course, would be making him eligible for parole after 25, like this court did the first go around in its order before it withdrew. I also know that if he had raised the thing, he of course would have lost, because at that time the death penalty was okay for juveniles. So when he had his appeal, it was okay to execute juvenile. So Mr. Carr wouldn't have been Miller because.
And how old is Mr. Carr now?
He is 50 years old today. As of today, he's turned 50 today.
Are there any other questions? Thank you. We'll hear from you in rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. With Missouri murder before Furman, the highest degree of murder was called first-degree murder, and the sentence was natural life. There was no regulation on parole with that conviction at that time. After Furman, Missouri, the legislature created a form of murder called capital murder, and the sentence that was available for that was either death or life without parole for 50 years. And in 1984, the legislature acted again. Capital murder became first-degree murder, and the sentence was adjusted to life, to either death or life without parole. So that sort of gives you a little bit of the history involved with murder there. We're dealing with that middle group of offenders between 1973, 74, and 1984, the offenders who were under the age of 18 when they killed and received a sentence of life without parole for 50 years.
Was there any difference in the elements between capital murder and first-degree murder?
No, there's no difference in the elements.
So it's not significant that he was convicted of capital murder versus first degree murder?
No, no. This just tells you why there was a group of offenders before the court that had life without parole, and why this individual is before the court with a sentence of life without parole for 50 years. There, to my count, there are two other offenders like this, one named Jeffrey Scott, one named Hardy Bivens, and their direct appeals are cited in the respondent's brief. So the court, if it's inclined, can look at the facts involved in those murders as well. One thing that does make this offender different than the offender in Montgomery and Miller is that this offender is convicted of killing three different people, whereas the offenders in Miller, both offenders in Miller and the offender in Montgomery was convicted of killing one individual.
So that would be a factor that would be potentially a reason that he might not be eligible for parole, or an aggravator in if that was brought up at a resentencing.
At resentencing, I can answer that question, yes, clearly. Is it a factor that keeps him ineligible for parole? I think I cannot answer that question, yes. His sentence is life without parole for 50 years. He has three convictions. The trial judge ran the sentences concurrently. So the sentence is life without parole for 50 years. Now, what factors the parole board would ultimately consider in deciding whether to grant the individual parole or not to grant the person an early release, those are within the discretion of the parole board. I think, you know, the fact that he killed three people is certainly a factor.
The nature of the offense is something they look at.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Counsel, but it doesn't make the person ineligible, which was your question.
Mr. Carr argues that he got the sentence he got automatically, like Nathan and Hart did. At the time he was sentenced, did the jury have a choice between death and life without parole for 50? And they opted for the lower?
They did not. The state waived death in this case. So the jury there was not a classic penalty phase.
Because it really was automatic. It really was automatic in the same sense as Nathan and Hart were.
It was automatic, but I use that word automatic in quote marks, because at the time he received the minimum sentence that was available for him to receive. You know, today, after the passage of years, it's portrayed as the maximum sentence, but it was the minimum sentence.
Well, you could say that about Nathan and Hart. They yes. received the minimum, but
yes,
they also received the maximum for which they were eligible.
That is true, due to the nature of their offense. So, one factor that does distinguish this case from Miller and Montgomery is the number of victims involved here. The petitioner acknowledged during his opening statement that he is parole eligible in 2033 after serving 50 years in imprisonment. The question that's raised is whether that type of sentence, a sentence that is not life without parole, whether that violates the Eighth Amendment. And one thing that I would point the court to is the language in Montgomery, which speaks in terms of whether the individual has a meaningful opportunity for parole. And the term meaningful focuses on the word opportunity. And this individual does have the opportunity for parole, and he does have that opportunity. The irony of it here is that he was scheduled for that opportunity for parole before Montgomery and before Miller and before Graham and before Roper.
17 years from now.
That is correct. It is 17 years.
Can you address the fact that in Montgomery the court said the fact that Mr. Montgomery had been incarcerated for 46 years but had not had a parole hearing violated the Constitution and directed there be a hearing?
I respectfully disagree with that description of what the court said in Montgomery. The sentence that the offender had in Montgomery was life without parole. That was its language. Now, it did not say that Mr. Montgomery's immediate incarceration was unlawful. It said that the sentence that he received, life without parole, was unlawful. So the court did not...
And the court will look at Montgomery to see, because it does refer to the 46 years.
It does.
Without
it does,
hearing
absolutely.
And it was improper.
And the court does not use the language that a sentence of life without parole for 50 years is unconstitutional, or that his actual incarceration that day was
right.
unlawful. Now, what it says is that, it suggests is at some future point, his period of incarceration would be unlawful. Now, I would also refer the court to the language that's contained in Graham, which also points to or suggests that a line of 50 years is the appropriate line. On page 79 in the Graham decision, the court wrote, Graham's sentence guarantees he will die in prison without meaningful opportunity to get release, even if he spends the next half century attempting to atone for his crime. So the court does look at the 50-year mark, the half century, as being a significant mark, and they provided language to that effect in Graham. So I think the court's noticing that both Montgomery and Graham, you're looking at whether there's a meaningful opportunity for parole, and that meaningful opportunity exists.
And is there a definition that we should apply as to what meaningful means?
Meaningful. What we know that it does not mean is that it does not mean that it depends on an action by the executive, like clemency or a pardon or something like that, because both of those were ruled out in Miller and Montgomery. Meaningful opportunity, is the individual eligible for parole?
Ever, or after they die, before they die, before their statistical likelihood of death by age 70, what does it mean?
Whether there will be an opportunity for parole, whether they are eligible for parole. Now,
well, what does the meaningful mean, I think was the question.
The meaningful means, is the opportunity meaningful? And in this case, I think that the opportunity that this individual has is a meaningful opportunity. While, you know, the petitioner comments that he's turning 50 today, the thing that needs to be noted is that he does become parole eligible when he is 66. Now, you know, respondent discusses in the brief, you know, what is the offender's life expectancy? And the petitioner comments in his brief that he becomes parole eligible 10 years before the conclusion of his life expectancy. In respondent's brief, I suggest that it's 15 years before the conclusion of life expectancy. Whichever set of figures you look at, he does become eligible before the end of his life expectancy.
Did the Supreme Court in Montgomery characterize the period of release on parole as some years of life outside prison walls?
Yes.
And you argue that there's no requirement of quality of life.
That is correct. Yeah. Well, at least not from either Miller or Montgomery. Now, but these are really issues that the court does not have to delve in to make that determination. Whether you actually look at life expectancy as determining whether a person's life is certainly subject to a lot of criticism. One could argue that you should look at the maximum life expectancy at, say, 90 or 100 and declare it at that point. Some people might say, well, you look at the statistics and declare it at, you know, 72 or 75 at that point. There's a lot of variables that can go into determining life expectancy, you know, genetics, behavior such as alcohol, smoking, and the like, race, gender, things of that note. And, you know, it's not proper to look at some of those characteristics in determining what one's sentence should be.
What guidance do we receive from other jurisdictions who have already ruled on this? Obviously, there's a split. What kind of split and what guidance?
There is a split, and the split, there are some courts that say that 50 years is too long. The petitioner cites one of those jurisdictions. The respondent cites, can't remember the state right now, it may have been New Jersey, that said that 50 years is proper. The way to look at those cases and reconcile those is through the language that is given by the Supreme Court in Montgomery, and that is there a reasonable opportunity, or is there a meaningful opportunity for parole? And, you know, this individual is going to be parole eligible at age 66. That is a meaningful opportunity for parole. I asked the Missouri Department of Corrections how many individuals were in the department who were over the age of 66, and the answer was 600. I'm not willing to say that those people, whenever they come before the parole board, do not have a meaningful opportunity for parole just because of their age. That's
Counsel, if the court decides that Mr. Carr falls within Miller, or a reasonable extension of Miller, but not within the Senate, the Miller fix statute. Do we have the authority to declare him eligible today or at some future day for parole, or should we must we resentence him, send him back for resentencing under Hart?
The form of action before the court is as a writ of habeas corpus. And under the court's writ jurisdiction, the court, I believe, has the power to fashion an equitable remedy in the form that the court sees fit to fashion. An equitable remedy could be to order a resentencing. An equitable remedy could be to order his release unless his release, or to determine that he should be released unless the parole board finds him to be eligible for parole. I guess what I'm getting to is that you, as part of your habeas jurisdiction, I believe you would have the power to order some form of parole eligibility. And before the Senate bill was passed by the legislature, that was the action this court took. Was by issuing a writ that created parole eligibility.
As Judge Fisher pointed out, the U.S. Supreme Court can do what they want to do, and they do. But where do we step in the state court system at whatever criteria we would use to say to substitute our own judgment for the trial judge's or the jury's judgment on what's a reasonable period of time to serve a sentence? I mean, we have life expectancy goes up, whatever. Where should we be, what criteria should we be using to put our judgment as far as what's the right length of parole?
That's a good question. There are a lot of variables in all of that, and which one is the right variable or the most important variable, and to prioritize those variables, I'm not sure how the court would do that. That's why I've been trying to focus the court's attention on the actual language in Montgomery that asks whether there is a reasonable opportunity for parole for this individual, and this individual has that opportunity at the age of 66.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Counselor, I have a question for you about life expectancy.
Okay.
For years in this state, there are certain life expectancy tables that we've been able to take judicial notice of.
Correct.
I'm concerned that if a court would consider any life expectancy or variables such as race or sex in consideration of a life expectancy, that would violate equal protection. What's your thoughts on that?
I don't believe that we should use life expectancy. I think a sentence beyond life expectancy is unconstitutional, I also have cited the cases where I believe geriatric is unconstitutional. The language used by the opinions, Graham, Miller.
Well, but so in what people call a functional equivalent of life without, if what sum of years is that?
Well, they're right. The courts have been pretty, have not really said a sum of years. It seems like the ones that have found that it's unconstitutional have been pretty much 860 and above. But nobody has actually come right out and said it. What they focus in on are the first, it's got to, the opportunity for release has to be realistic. It has to be a meaningful opportunity based upon maturation and rehabilitation. It's not just a mathematical formula to where, okay, if we're going to predict you die on this year, so we're going to give you 1 year out on the street. They also mentioned that there has to be a chance of fulfillment and a chance of reconciliation with society.
Well, there's none of that in Miller and Montgomery.
Maybe it's in Graham.
I mean, there's. Yeah.
But I do know that they specifically say that there has to be a chance, and I thought it was in Montgomery, but maybe not. That there has to be a chance for fulfillment outside of the prison walls. I know that is a statement from one of the three cases, and I forget which one.
I think it was Graham that said that offenders, that the meaningful opportunity has got to be provided before offenders so that they will never be able to fit into reenter into society.
Exactly. So they have to have hope, right? And an opportunity to actually make a life of themselves. We're not here to try to predict, okay, we think you're going to die 15 years from now, so we're going to give you 1 year out on the streets to die on the streets.
Well, isn't there's a difference between eligibility and whether or not you should be released? I mean, they're still talking of, that's the problem when you start mixing those factors that way. There might be different considerations for whether you're eligible and different considerations for whether you should be released.
Well, certainly, it is eligibility. You're not entitled to ever be released. They have made that clear. But it seems to me that if you're able to demonstrate that you have matured and have been rehabilitated, that you should be released. And in fact, Montgomery said it should be the rare individual that's irreparably corrupt that we keep behind bars. And if the inmate can show that it was just transient immaturity, they are entitled. They shall be released. And Montgomery says that.
Yeah. How do we deal with the fact that Miller and Montgomery dealt with single homicide cases as opposed to multiple homicide cases?
I see my time's up if I can answer. The facts didn't deal with multiple, but there was nothing about the opinion that focused in on the offense. In fact, when you do a categorical challenge, the whole reason behind doing the categorical challenge is to step away from the actual facts of the offense. Instead, the focus for these type of things is on the juvenile. So whether or not the juvenile has killed one or two or three people doesn't matter whether or not they should be eligible. At the back end, I can't say that the parole board's not going to consider it. And I think that's when the consideration will come into play as to whether or not to release the individual.
And I know we have a chart with the states that have adopted statutes that set a time for eligibility for parole. What about the states who have are addressing this judicially? What guidance do we receive from them?
Well, I think it's a mixed guidance, and basically what the courts that have found have pretty much have focused in about the age. The earliest I could find is Bear Cloud, Wyoming, and that was the age of 61, and that was a homicide and another offense where it was aggravated. Right? So the homicide is actually ineligible because of the statute they've enacted, but then he had another offense, and they stacked him up to where he was ineligible for age 61, and they said that was unconstitutional. Because it only allowed geriatric release.
Are the ages that you give in your brief on pages 8 and 9, are those that those are unconstitutional, or was that the remedy that the court fashioned?
I'm not sure. I don't have my brief in front of me.
I'll go back and reread that section.
Counsel, the states that you list on pages 56 to 57, where you indicate legislatures across the country have changed the number of years before they're eligible for parole, you state those were all done legislatively?
Right.
Just like in Missouri?
Right.
So why in this situation shouldn't this be a legislative fix as opposed to the court acting?
Well, because first of all, the court has to deal with an unconstitutional sentence. Now, the way that what has happened on those most of those legislatures, what's happened is the Supreme Courts of those states have said these sentences are unconstitutional, and in reaction to that, the legislatures have gone in and enacted to try to give guidance, a firm line, instead of courts have said, okay, this doesn't give a meaningful opportunity.
So why shouldn't we do that too?
Well, I think this court should reverse Mr. Carr's.
But without specifically saying the year, but let the legislature, who makes decisions on punishment, make those decisions.
Well, I think the court can only address the situation. First of all, is this an unconstitutional sentence? And then if the court finds that it's an unconstitutional sentence, then the legislature, just like they did with the Miller, finally, they can enact legislation to deal with the problem.
You're saying it should be like Hart, where we said, in the absence of legislation, we send it back down for a new hearing or 25-year sentence, but invite the legislature to take action.
Right, exactly. In other words, we have an unconstitutional sentence. It'd be preferable if the legislature fix some firm number of years. Now, like I say, I think there's limits as to the number of years that the legislature could fix. We just can't put any number.
Do you agree with your opposing counsel that the court has the authority under its habeas to fashion a remedy, or do you think, are you in the camp that believes the court does not have the authority to fashion a remedy and it must require resentencing?
I think the court can. The court did in the 80 previous cases. If the legislature hadn't acted, we'd have 80 individuals based on this court's order. And I'm not here to say that the court did something that they weren't authorized to do. I mean, it's apparently the court believed that it had the authority.
Well, we certainly had a lot of motions for rehearing filed.
We certainly did.
By both sides.
We certainly did.
The reason I asked the question is because he waded into the remedy, and I wanted you to have an opportunity to respond. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.